Chapter 57. Alone on my knees in the presence of God, on the 1st of January 1855, I took the resolution of opposing the acts of simony and tyranny of Bishop O'Regan. I was far from understanding the legal consequences of my struggle. My only object was to force him to be honest, just, and Christian toward my people who had left their country and all that was dear to them in Canada to live in peace in Illinois under what we then considered the holy authority of the Church of Christ. But we were absolutely unwilling to be slaves of any man in the land of liberty. If anyone at that hour could have shown me that this struggle would lead to a complete separation from the Church of Rome, I would have shrank from the task. My only ambition was to purify my church. From the beginning, however, I had a presentiment that the power of the bishops would be too much for me, and that sooner or later they would crush me. But my hope was that when I fell, others would take my place and fight the battles of the Lord, till a final victory would bring the church back to the blessed days when she was the spotless spouse of the Lamb. In the autumn of 1856, our struggle against the Bishop of Chicago had taken proportions which could not have been anticipated either by me or by the Roman Catholic hierarchy of America. The whole press of the United States and Canada, both political and religious, were discussing the causes and the probable results of the contest. At first, the bishops were indignant at the conduct of my Lord O'Regan. They had seen with pleasure that a priest from his own diocese would probably force him to be more cautious and less scandalous in his public and private dealings with the clergy and the people. But they also hoped that I should be paralyzed by the sentence of excommunication, and that the people, frightened by these fomentations, would withdraw the support they had given me. They were assured by Spink that I would lose my suit at Urbana, and should, when lodged in the penitentiary, become powerless to do any mischief in the church. But their confidence was soon changed into dismay when they saw that the people laughed at the excommunication, that I had gained my suit, and that I was triumphing on that very battlefield from which no priest, since Luther and Knox, had come out unscathed. Everywhere the sound of alarm was heard, and I was denounced as a rebel and a schismatic. The whole body of the bishops repaired to hurl their most terrible fulminations at my head. But before taking their last measure to crush me, a supreme effort was made to show us what they considered our errors. The Reverend Monsieur Brassard, curate of Longueuil, and Reverend Isaac de Saulnier, president of St. Hyacinth's College, were sent by the people and bishops of Canada to show me the scandal of my proceedings and press me to submit to the will of the bishop by respecting the so-called sentence of excommunication. The choice of those two priests was very clever. They were certainly the most influential that could be sent. Mr. Brassard had not only been my teacher and benefactor at the College of Nicolet, he had loved me since as his own child, and I cherished and respected him as my own father. The other, Reverend I. de Saulnier, had been my classmate in the college from 1822 to 1829, And we had been united during the whole period of that period, as well as since, by the bonds of the sincerest esteem and friendship. They arrived at St. Anne on the 24th, November 24th, 1856. I heard of their coming only a few minutes before their arrival, and nothing can express the joy I felt at the news. The confidence I had in their honesty and friendship gave me at once the hope that they would soon see the justice and holiness of our cause, and they would bravely take our side against our aggressor. But they had very different sentiments. Sincerely believing that I was an unmanageable schismatic who was creating an awful scandal in the church, they had not only been forbidden by the bishops to sleep in my house, but also to have any friendly and Christian communication with me. With no hatred against me, they were filled with horror at the thought that I should be so scandalous a priest, daring to trouble the peace and destroy the unity of the church. On their way, they had often been told that I was not the same man, and that I had become sour and gloomy, abusive, insolent, and haughty, that also I would insult them and perhaps advise the people to turn them away from my premises. They were pleasantly disappointed, however, when they saw me running to meet them with the most sincere affection and joy. I told them that all the treasures of California brought to my house would not make me half so happy as I was made by their presence. I at once expressed my hope that they were the messengers sent by God to bring us peace and put an end to the deplorable state of things which was the cause of their long journey. Remarking that they were covered with mud, I invited them to go to their sleeping rooms to wash and refresh themselves. Sleeping rooms? Sleeping rooms, said Mr. Bissonnier. But our written instructions from the bishop who sent us forbid us to sleep here on account of your excommunication. Mr. Brossard answered, I must tell you, my dear Mr. Bissonnier, a thing which I have kept secret till now. After reading that prohibition of sleeping here, I said to the bishop that if he put such a restraint upon me, he could choose someone else to come. I requested him to let us both act according to our conscience and common sense, and today they tell me that we cannot begin our mission of peace by insulting a man who gives us such a friendly and Christian reception. The people of Canada have chosen us as their deputies because we are the most sincere friends of Chiniki. It is by keeping that character that we will best fulfill our sacred and solemn duties. I accept with pleasure the sleeping room offered me. Mr. Bissonnier rejoined, I accept it also, for I did not come here to insult my best friend, but to save him. These kind words of my guests added to my joy. I told them, if you are here to obey the voice of your conscience and the dictates of your common sense, there is a glorious task before you. You will soon find that the people and priests of St. Anne have also done nothing but listen to the voice of their honest conscience and follow the laws of common sense in their conduct toward the bishop. But, I added, this is not the time to explain my position, but the time to wash your dusty faces and refresh yourselves. Here are your rooms. Make yourself at home. After supper, they handed me the letters addressed to me by the bishops of Montreal, London, and Toronto to induce me to submit to my superior and offer me the assurance of the most sincere friendship and devotedness if I would obey.
I answered, "If I have fallen into a bottomless abyss, as you say, and that you will draw me out of it, not only God and men will bless you, but I will also forever bless you for your charity. The first thing, however, that you have to do here is to see if I am really fallen with my people into that bottomless abyss of which you speak." "But are you not excommunicated?" quickly rejoined Mr. de Saulnier. "And notwithstanding the excommunication, have you not continued to say your mass, preach, and hear the confessions of the people? Are you not then fallen into the state of irregularity and schism, which separates you entirely from the church, and to which the Pope alone can restore you?" "No, my dear de Saulnier," I answered, "I am no more excommunicated than you are, for the simple reason that an act of excommunication which is not signed and certified is unworthy of any attention. Here is the act of the so-called excommunication which makes so much noise in the world. Examine it yourself. See if it is signed by the bishop or certified by anybody." And I handed him the document. After they had examined it for more than half an hour without saying a word, he at last broke his silence. "If I had not seen it with my own eyes, I could never have believed that a bishop can play such a sacrilegious comedy in the face of the world. You have several times published it in the press, but I confess that your best friends, and I among the rest, did not believe you. It could not enter our minds that a bishop should be so devoid of common honesty as to have proclaimed before the whole world that you were excommunicated. But in the name of common sense, why is it that he has not signed his sentence of excommunication, or get it signed and countersigned by some authorized people, when it is so evident that he wanted to excommunicate you?" "His reason is very clear," I answered. "I had threatened to bring him before the civil court if he dared to destroy my character by interdict or excommunication, and he found that the only way to save himself was not to sign that paper. The first thing I would have to do in a prosecution is prove the signature of the bishop. Where could I find a witness who would swear that this is his signature? Would you swear it yourself, my dear de Saulnier?" "Oh, no, for surely it is not his signature, nor that of his grand vicar or secretary. But without going any further," added he, "we must confess to you that we have talked to the bishop when passing through Chicago, asking him if he had made any public or private inquest against you, and if he had found you guilty of any crime. He was embarrassed by our questions, but we told him that it was necessary for us to know all about your public and private character when we were coming to press you to reconcile yourself to your bishop. He answered that he had never made any inquest about you, though you had requested him several times to do it, for the simple reason that he was persuaded that you were one of his best priests. Your only defect, he said, was a spirit of stubbornness and want of respect and obedience to your superior, and your meddling with his dealings with his dioceans, with which you had no business. He told us also that you refused to go to Cahokia, but his face became so red and his tongue so strangely lisping when he said that I suspected it was a falsehood, and we have now before our eyes your documents which prove that it was more than a falsehood, it was a lie." He proffered another lie also when he said that he had signed himself the act of excommunication, for surely this is not his handwriting. Such conduct from a bishop is very strange. If you would appeal to the Pope and go to Rome with such documents in hand against that bishop, you would have an easy victory over him. For the canons of the Church are clear and unanimous. A bishop who pronounces such grave sentences against a priest and makes use of false signatures is himself suspended and excommunicated ipso facto for a whole year. Mr. Brassard added, cannot we confess to Timothy that the opinion of the bishops of Canada is that Bishop O'Regan is a perfect rogue? If Timothy would appeal to the Pope, he would soon be reinstated by a public decree of His Holiness. Our discussion kept us up till 3 a.m. without coming to any satisfactory issue. We adjourned to the next day and went to take some rest after a short prayer. The 25th of November at 10 a.m., we shut ourselves up in my study and resumed the discussion of the best plan of putting an end to the existing difficulties. To show them my sincere desire of stopping those noisy and scandalous struggles without compromising the sacred principles which had guided me from the beginning of our troubles, I consented to sacrifice my position of pastor of St. Anne, provided Mr. Brassard would be installed in my place. It was decided, however, that I should remain with him as his vicar and help in the management of the spiritual and temporal affairs of the colony. The promise was given me that on that condition, the bishop would withdraw his so-called sentence, give back to the French Canadians of Chicago the church he had taken away from them, put a French-speaking priest at the head of the congregation, and forgive and forget that he might consider our irregular conduct towards him after we should have signed the following document. To His Lordship O'Regan, Bishop of Chicago. My Lord, as my actions and writing in opposition to your orders have, since a few months, given some scandals and caused some people to think that I would rather prefer to be separated from our Holy Church then submit to your authority, I hasten to express the regret I feel for such acts and writings, and to show to the world and to you, my bishop, my firm desire to live and die a Catholic. I hasten to write to your lordship that I submit to your sentence, and that I promise hereafter to exercise the holy ministry only with your permission. In consequence, I respectfully request your lordship to withdraw the censures and interdicts you have pronounced against me, and those who have had any spiritual communication with me. I am, my lord, your devoted son in Christ, C. Timothy. It was 11 p.m. when I consented to sign this document, which was to be handed to the bishop and have any value only on the above conditions. The two deputies were beside themselves with joy at the success of their mission, and at my readiness to sacrifice myself for the sake of peace. Monsieur de Saunier said, now we see that Timothy has been right with his people from the beginning, that he never meant to create a schism and to put himself at the head of a rebellious party, to defy the authority of the Church. If the bishop does not want to live in peace with the people and pastor of St. Anne after such a sacrifice, we will tell him that it is not Timothy, but Bishop O'Regan who wants a schism. We will appeal to the Pope, I will go with Timothy, and we will easily get there the removal of that bishop from the Diocese of Chicago. Mr. Brassard agreed and added that he also would accompany me to Rome to be the witness of my innocence and the bad conduct of the bishop. He added that it would not take him a week to raise twice the amount of money in Montreal we would require to go to Rome. After thanking them for what they had done, I asked Mr. Dussonnier if he would be brave enough to repeat before my whole people what he had just said before me and Mr. Burchard in the presence of God. Surely I would be most happy to repeat before your whole people that it is impossible to find fault with you in what you have done till now, but you know very well I will never have such an opportunity, for it is now 11 at night. Your people are soundly sleeping, and I must start tomorrow morning at 6 to take the Chicago train at Kankakee at 8 a.m. I answered, "All right." We knelt together to make a short prayer, and I led them to their rooms, wishing them refreshing sleep after the hard work of the day. 10 minutes later, I was in the village, knocking at the door of 6 of my most respectable parishioners and telling them, "Please do not lose a moment. Go with your fastest horse to such and such a part of the colony, knock at every door, and tell the people to be at the church at 5 o'clock in the morning to hear with their own ears what the deputies from Canada have to say about our past struggles with the Bishop of Chicago. Tell them to be punctual at 5 o'clock in their pews, where the deputies will address them with words which they must hear at any cost." A little before 5 the next morning, Mr. Dussonnier, full of surprise and anxiety, knocked at my door and said, "Chiniki, do you not hear that strange noise of buggies and carriages which seem to be coming from every quarter of the globe? What does it mean? Have your people become crazy to come to church at this dark hour, so long before the dawn of day?" "What? What?" I answered. "I was sleeping so soundly that I have heard nothing yet. What do you mean by this noise of carriages and buggies around the chapel? Are you dreaming?" "No, I'm not dreaming," he answered. "Not only do I hear the noise of a great many carriages, wagons, and buggies, but though it is pretty dark, I see several hundred of them around the chapel. I hear the voice of a great multitude of men, women, and even children, putting questions to each other and giving answers which I cannot understand. They make such a noise by their laughing and jokes. Can you tell me what this means? I have never been so puzzled in my life." I answered him, "Do you not see that you are dreaming? Let me dress myself, that I may go and see something of that strange and awful dream." Mr. Brassard, though a little more calm than Dussonnier, was not himself without some anxiety at the strange noise of that multitude of carriages, horses, and people around my house and chapel at such an hour. Knocking at my door, he said, "Please, Chiniki, explain that strange mystery. Do that people come to play us some bad trick and punish us for our intruding in their affairs?" "Be quiet," I answered. "My dear friends, you have nothing to fear from that good and intelligent people. Do you not remember that last night the Dussonnier said that he would be honest and brave enough to repeat before my whole people what he had said before you and me and in the presence of God? I suppose that some of the angels of heaven have heard those words and have carried them this night to every family, inviting them to be here at the chapel that night, that they might hear from your own lips what you think of the grand and glorious battle they are fighting in this distant land for the principles of truth and justice, as the gospel secures them to every disciple of Christ." "Well, well," said Dussonnier, "there is only one Chiniki in the world to take me in such a trap, and there is only one people under heaven to do what this people is doing here. I would never have given you that answer had I not been sure that I would never have had the opportunity to fulfill it. Who would think you would play me such a trick?" But he added, "Though I know that this will terribly compromise me before certain parties, It is too late to retract, and I will fulfill my promise. It is impossible to express my own joy and the joy of that noble people when they heard from the very lips of those deputies that after spending a whole day and two nights in examining all that had been done by their pastor and by them in that solemn and fearful contest, they declared that they had not broken any law of God, nor of His holy church, and had kept themselves in the very way prescribed by the canons. Tears of joy were rolling down every cheek when they heard Mr. de Saulier telling them, which Mr. Brassard confirmed, that the bishop had no possible right to interdict their pastor, since he had told them that he was one of his best priests, and that they had done well not to pay any attention to an act of excommunication which was a sham and sacrilegious comedy, not having been signed or certified by any known person. Both deputies explained the document I had signed and the conditions attached to it. They continued, "If he, Bishop O'Regan, does not accept those conditions, we will tell him it is not Chiniki, but he who wants a schism, and we will go with Mr. Chiniki to Rome to plead his cause and prove his innocence before His Holiness." After this, we all knelt to thank and bless God, and never people went back to their homes with more cheerful hearts than the people of St. Anne on that morning of November 25, 1856. At 6 a.m., Mr. de Saulnier left for Chicago to present my conditional act of submission to the bishop, and press him in the name of the bishops of Canada and in the name of all the most sacred interests of the church to accept the sacrifice and the submission of the people of St. Anne, and to give them the peace they wanted and were purchasing at such a price. The Reverend Mr. Brassard had remained with me waiting for a letter from the bishop to accompany me and put the last seal to our reconciliation. The next day, he received the following note from Mr. de Saulnier, Bishopric of Chicago, November 26, 1856, the Reverend Mr. Brassard. "Monsieur, it is advisable and indispensable that you should come here with Mr. Chiniki as soon as possible. In consequence, I expect you both day after tomorrow in order to settle that matter definitely. Respectfully yours, Isaac de Saulnier." After reading that letter with Mr. Brassard, I said, "These cold words mean nothing good. I regret that you have not gone with de Saulnier to the bishop. You know the levity and weakness of his character, always bold with his words, but soft as wax at the least pressure. My fear is that the bulldog tenacity of my Lord O'Regan has frightened him, and all his courage and bravado has melted away before the fierce temper of the Bishop of Chicago. But let us go. Be sure, however, my dear Mr. Brassard, that if the bishop does not accept you to remain at the head of this colony to protect and guide it, no consideration whatever will induce me to betray my people and let them become the prey of the wolves which want to devour them." We arrived in Chicago the 28th at about 10 a.m. Mr. de Saulnier was waiting for us. He was pale as a dead man. Taking him a short distance from the crowd, I asked him, "What news?" He answered, "The news is that you and Mr. Brassard have nothing to do but to take your bags and go to Canada. The bishop is unwilling to make any arrangements with you. He wants me to be the temporary pastor of St. Anne, and he wants you with Mr. Brassard to go quietly back to Canada and tell the bishops to mind their own business. And what has become of the promise you have given me and to my people to go with me and Mr. Brassard to Rome if the bishop refused the proposed arrangements you had fixed yourselves. Tap, tap, answered he. The bishop does not care a straw about your going or not going to Rome. He has put me as his grand vicar at the head of the colony of St. Anne, from which you must go in the shortest time possible. Now, De Saulnier, I answered, you are a traitor and a Judas. And if you want to have the pay of Judas, I advise you to go to St. Anne. There you will receive what you deserve. The beauty and importance of that great colony have tempted you, and you have sold me to the bishop in order to become a grand vicar and eat the fruits of the vine I have planted there. But you will soon see your mistake. If you have any pity for yourself, I advise you never to put your feet into that place any more. The Saulnier answered, the bishop will not make any arrangements with you unless you retract publicly what you have written against him on account of his taking possession of the Church of the French Canadians of Chicago, and you must publish in the press that he was right and honest in what he did in that circumstance. My dear Mr. Brassard, I said, can I make such a declaration conscientiously and honorably? That venerable man answered me, you cannot consent to do such a thing. The Saulnier, I said, do you hear? Mr. Brassard, and your conscience, if you have any, tell you the same thing. If you take sides against me with a man whom you have yourself declared yesterday to be a sacrilegious thief, you are not better than he is. Go and work with him. As for me, I'm going back to St. Anne. What will you do there, answered Mr. De Saulnier, when the bishop has forbidden you to remain? What will I do, I answered? I will teach those true disciples of Jesus Christ to despise and shun the tyrants and the traitors. Go, traitor, and finish your Judas work. Adieu. I then threw myself into the arms of Mr. Brassard, who was almost speechless, suffocated in his sobs and tears. I pressed him to my heart and said, adieu, my dear Mr. Brassard. Go back to Canada and tell my friends how the cowardice and ambition of that traitor has ruined the hope we had of putting an end to this deplorable state of affairs. I go back among my brethren of St. Anne with more determination than ever to protect them against the tyranny and impiety of our despotic rulers. I will be more easy than ever. It will be more easy than ever to show them that the Son of God has not redeemed us on the cross that we might be slaves of these heartless traitors and souls. I will more earnestly than ever teach my people to shun the modern gospel of the bishops in order to follow the old gospel of Jesus Christ as the only hope and life of our poor fallen humanity. Mr. Brassard wanted to say something, but his voice was suffocated by his sobs. The only words he could utter when pressing me to his heart were, adieu, dear friend, adieu.